Brendan O'Connor on RTE Radio 1 with Allcare Pharmacy. Sign up to our loyalty programme and reap the rewards at Allcare Pharmacy, Ireland's largest community pharmacy network.
Brendan O'Connor on RTE Radio 1 with Allcare Pharmacy. Discover a healthcare team that's always here for you at Allcare Pharmacy, Ireland's largest community pharmacy network.
Good morning, you're very welcome to the show. Before we meet our panel, let's have a look at the front pages of the papers. So the Sunday Times is leading with IPAS arson was an attempt to kill Fir Gardaí. And John Mooney and Ruby Hegarty are reporting. Listen to this. Gardaí are now treating the attack, which took place around 8:30 p.m. on Halloween night, as potentially attempted murder, reckless endangerment and arson, given the fact that the stairs in the building were set ablaze, which would have prevented occupants escaping. The attack was not carried out by passers-by who threw fireworks through a window, as previously thought, but it was a premeditated act of violence, possibly involving a number of people, which could have resulted in the deaths of women and children. The Irish Sunday Mirror is also leading with that, and their headline is Kids Flee Arson Terror, Emergency Queues Rescue Asylum Seekers from Burning Hostel. The Business Post is leading with the sale of PTSB, and they say PTSB $2.3 billion price tag at risk from draconian central bank. This is, they're saying, well, an analyst is saying that the central bank needs to allow the buyer of the bank to repatriate surplus capital, and that that will make the bank worth more to a buyer. The Sunday Independent have a poll, and their headline out of that is 53% say Martin should quit as Fianna Fáil leader. The Irish Mail on Sunday is leading with another of DJ Carey's victims. And the Sun on Sunday is leading with rapist fireman turns Crosby's brave victim deserves a public apology from Dublin City Council, according to Dublin City Councillor Mannix Flynn. And the Sunday World is leading with Red Hurley talking about, in quotes, the headline, "My Secret Love Child." Showbiz legend reveals his marriage is over after he told wife that he fathered a daughter on one night stand a decade before they met. And he says in it, and I think there's a whole, there's an epic story of Ireland in this. He says, "I should have come clean in the beginning. That was the mistake I made. And it was a stupid mistake because there was nothing to hide. Telling seems a simple thing to have done today, but it was more complicated at the time. And then it was too late as time went on." OK, our panel this morning, Gerard Howland is a public affairs consultant and an Irish Times columnist. Scott Lucas is professor of US and international politics at the Clinton Institute in UCD. Louise Byrne is a political correspondent at the Irish Examiner, and Dr. Emma Howard is an economist. Gerard Howland, you picked the Mail on Sunday piece on that IPAS centre in Drogheda. You are facing serious consequences, IPAS arson is told. Gerard, I think people are like kind of half unshockable in one way these days. People are shocked, and rightfully so, at this. There was a woman on the news last night, just I think a local woman who had no connection with this place whatsoever. She actually was crying, properly crying, when she was asked about it.
And there's a picture with that piece purporting to show somebody leaning into the building, pouring out some sort of flammable liquid.
It seems to be that they poured petrol down the stairs.
So you see that in movies featuring the Ku Klux Klan. You see it in other horrible situations as fiction. But for it to be fact, for somebody to be so evil and deranged, and it is an evil act, is truly shocking. That there is even a tiny little bit of that in this country, which unfortunately we have to acknowledge there is very disturbing. And it's how do the rest of us who are not like that, regardless of our view on migration and immigration, and they're very different topics that shouldn't be conflated, and it's unhelpful when they are, it's to see people, fellow human beings of a different skin colour, of a different cultural background, from a different country, as somehow subhuman. And that is what this is about. This is taking not just the life and limb, but actually the very dignity of their humanity from people who are deemed to be different and because of their difference are somehow not as good as us. This is profoundly disturbing. It is a virus in our society. And when you have then, as we had, very focused attacks on some people of Indian heritage around Dublin, when you have name calling on the street and on buses, if Dublin bus drivers, I saw recently a man at his job, there was just a throwaway remark, nasty, vile, and all that low level stuff, and then percolating up into something like this, we have a problem in this country. It's a solvable problem. The vast majority of us, even if we have different positions, are on the right side of it.
Okay.
We have to pull together.
We might come back to the broader conversation in a minute. But Louise, you were looking at that Sunday Times piece, "I Pass Arson Was an Attempt to Kill."
Yeah, and I think it's quite shocking because, I mean, initially when the report started coming through early yesterday morning, there were suggestions that there were fireworks thrown into the building and that this is what started the fire. This, of course, happened on Halloween. So there was a lot of fireworks on Friday evening. Now what they're saying is that the fireworks could have been put or fired at the building as a distraction tactic to make people flee upstairs. And then the stairs were set on, you know, the petrol was put on the stairs and the stairs set on fire. And that is quite terrifying. And I mean, I think if you look at the broader context, and I know we can't paint everyone with the same brush, but a lot of the people who say they are against immigration and these IPAS centres opening up say that they want to protect the women and the children of their communities. And if you look at the people who were involved here, 4 children, including an infant, were among 5 people rescued from the top floor of the IPAS centre. That 5th person was very likely those children's mother or some kind of relative. You know, do we only protect Irish women and children? Do we not protect other children of other nationalities who have come here seeking refuge? And there are broader conversations to be had about the IPAS system, sure. And those need to be had, and need to be had in a calmer way and a more dignified way than we have seen over the last couple of years, but I think in particular over the last week or two. But this is not the answer, and putting people's lives at risk are not the answer, especially young children who, I mean, this is not their fault. It's not their fault that they are here. And I would question why anyone would think that this is an acceptable thing to do to another human being, because that's what they are. They're human beings, regardless of where they came from, the colour of their skin. They are young children who deserve as much protection as Irish children.
Scott Lucas, I'm always interested in your view as a kind of a relative outsider in this country. You maybe see things a bit more objectively, and you also see it in the context of being from America. What does this look like to you?
Well, I think the immediate context for me, Brendan, is having lived in the UK for 35 years before I moved here last year. And what I've seen in my former home, with great regret, has been a growing number of attempts to firebomb hotels with asylum seekers. Most notably during the 2 weeks of rioting, and it was rioting, mainly by the hard right last summer. And that was being fueled by disinformation across social media. It was being fueled by, let's be honest here, by race. It was fueled in some cases by hatred of certain people's religion. And I do a lot of work on UK media. So I've spent months trying to get facts out about migration, asylum seekers, refugees. The UK is not facing a migration crisis. I could tell you why in another conversation. But all that discussion around facts and around what is actually happening in the UK, and I would say in Ireland, gets drowned out by sometimes by superficial rhetoric. And we've seen that from certain political leaders in Ireland in the past week. And it gets drowned out by that fringe who really have a sense of hatred. And I think fundamentally.
Yeah, I also, just on an interesting note, people might not have seen this, I saw Elon Musk talking on a podcast. No, it was sent to me yesterday, I'm not sure when it was, but talking about, and we won't get into City West because there are people charged and before the courts with that, but talking about the case of the 10-year-old girl that was associated with the City West thing. But the way he was talking about it, you know, facty, seemingly facty, but completely twisting everything about it.
Absolutely right. And this is the same Elon Musk who this week said again, as he said since the start of the year, civil war is coming to Britain. And he has a social media platform where he allows others to repeat that. And again, I'm saying this because I love my new home. I absolutely love my new home. I love the fact, for example, that we took in 120,000 refugees from Ukraine under protection, given what happened there. And I'm going to put out one fact to juxtapose that. It was good we took in that 120,000. The number of people who are under IPAS right now are about 33,000. If you really want to talk about the wave of inward migration that came, it was because of that Russian invasion of Ukraine. So let's be honest here. A lot of the invective against those in IPAS is not because they're swamping the country. It's because they don't look like us. They aren't part of us. And it deflects from the real issues here. What are the real issues here? There are people who cannot get houses in Ireland. There are people who are worried about getting education for their kids. They're worried about people about having adequate health care. There's all those problems about fundamental public services. And if the government can't provide for those services, some people will deflect onto, they'll blame the asylum seeker, the refugee, the immigrant.
Emma, as an economist, is it a deflection, though, to say that we took 120,000 Ukrainians in here on very, very generous terms originally, and that a country does only have so much capacity, and that it does possibly impact on the level of services, housing, etc., available to other people? And do we need to actually be kind of honest with people about that?
I think we need to be really honest with people about migration. And I think, Simon Harris's comments that the migration numbers are too high didn't first of all talk about what are our migration numbers, what's been happening recently, and why do we need migration, and what are the trade-offs were we to reduce those numbers. So if you look at what's actually happening with migration in this country, we saw a 16% drop in migration numbers in the most recent figures from the CSO.
And I think a 40% drop in asylum seekers from last year to this year so far.
Exactly, which is again a separate issue. So we need to separate the two. So there's problems with the IPAS system. We have a moral obligation to protect people who are fleeing from war, from persecution, from extreme weather events
to the point that Micheál Martin made that 80% of those. I know there are a certain amount then do get in on appeal, but that in first instance, 80% of people who come here seeking asylum are refused asylum because they're not entitled to it.
And that's, I guess, a separate issue from our migration overall. Okay, so if we look at our migration numbers overall, about half of those migrants who came in the last year are EU, UK or returning Irish, right? And the other half are from other countries. Now, if we look at our ageing population, our requirements for that number one issue of housing in our country, that we need to build more houses, just on housing alone, the Irish Fiscal Advisory Council has estimated we need an extra 80,000 construction workers to meet those housing needs. That's not even thinking about the other infrastructural needs that we have. So where are those workers going to come from if we don't have inward migration? If we look at things like our health service...
Okay, and we have a system for that, don't we? And again, it's not the IPAS system. We have
It's not the IPAS system. It's a separate system. But to say that our migration numbers are too high, if we're to reduce those numbers, what we're going to do is we're going to reduce economic growth. We're going to fail to meet. So yes, these numbers coming in are putting strains on our health service, on our housing service, but they're also servicing those services. So the majority of our health service, more than half of our doctors, their primary qualifications are from abroad. About half of our nurses, it's similar. And if you look at even the funded places in our health system, last week the trade unions from the health service came out and said there's nearly 6,500 vacancies that they cannot fill. So we need these migrants coming into our country. And this rhetoric of saying numbers are too high feeds that racism and that anti-migrant sentiment that is driving things like these attacks on the IPAS centres.
Gerard, I think though, and you wanted to talk about Cliff Taylor had a piece in the Irish Times yesterday. Let's talk about immigration logically and dispassionately. To be logical and dispassionate, a lot of people will have agreed with Simon Harris, and Pascal Donoghue agreed with him, Micheál Martin seemed to back him up on the comments. A lot of people will feel that it is too high. Just a lot of people also, and I'm not I'm just saying, let's be honest about this. A lot of people will make a distinction between people who come in here to work on work visas and to work in the health service and all that, and people who come here seeking asylum and seeking shelter from the state.
Well, that distinction is critically important, and we in this conversation are trying to make it. I'm not sure to what extent Simon Harris succeeded in making it or understanding it. And I think there was a mix that was unhealthy, at least, if not somewhat nefarious. And if you look at that Cliff Taylor piece in the Irish Times yesterday, the truth is not that Ireland is full, but Ireland is in danger of running out of people. By 2035, our workforce will start to diminish for want of capacity. About 20-21% of our people in work at the moment are foreign. To meet our needs, we're not having the babies ourselves, you see. There's a baby shortage in Ireland. That's another shortage we suffer from. And to meet our needs, we need more and more people coming in. To mix that up with people seeking asylum is absolutely wrong. In relation to the 120,000 who came from Ukraine, we did the right thing at the right time. And the problem there is not that that has sucked up capacity, though I accept it has. It's that when that happened, was that 3 or 4 years ago now, the government decided that that major housing issue would be siphoned off to a place called the Department of Children at the time. It was not taken over by the Department of Housing. And on housing generally, this government...
Was there a problem as well that we were too generous and that we essentially, and you know, the infamous message sent out in several languages by Roger Corman at that time, that we essentially invited people here on better terms, and Ukrainians were, we know, coming from other countries to come to Ireland because there was a better deal.
Yeah, so in relation to the terms and conditions, they were effectively, I think, by and large, what would be available to Irish people and other European nationals in the circumstances. That was a show of solidarity. In relation to how that was dealt with, and this is to do with housing generally. In Ireland, we have a housing crisis. The housing crisis has never been a political priority despite anything and everything you were told. There's a huge amount of money being spent. There's one scheme after another. But the one thing that never happens, and this comes into various pieces about government and polls and Fianna Fáil and all the rest. The government over years has never centralised housing as a political priority in the department of the Taoiseach under then Taoiseach Harris, now Taoiseach Martin, where the Taoiseach of the day, who has the power to bring in all the agencies to hold them to account, that has never been done centrally. It's been point blank refused that it should be done centrally because it has been the objective to lay off that political responsibility elsewhere.
And
other things are subsets and consequences.
And we are now hiring a so-called housing czar to apparently coordinate.
The Taoiseach should be the housing czar.
Okay.
If you don't mind my saying.
Yeah. The big thing.
Okay, on the T-shirt, Louise.
Just to go back to the iPass really briefly. I think the big thing is it's like with everything in this country, the system just takes too long. And there are people staying in the system for far too long. And that's costing money. And
that
annoys the public.
And that is a government priority now.
Yeah,
they are speeding
up. So they say. But I mean, you've people.
I think it is happening.
Yeah,
it has been speeding up.
So they say. But you've people who could, you know, have the decision. They could be going into the workforce if they're granted leave to remain, or they could be moving on. And instead, you have this pinch point where people can't move on, and that's clogging up the system, and that's where you know the anger comes.
And they
comes.
Have, they are putting a lot more staff into that and speeding it up.
So
now, Louise, no, they are. It's Louise. It's facts.
Okay.
So let's move on to the Fianna Fáil leadership is still convulsing the media and the nation. So before we get to that poll, there's a couple of things I want to talk about. You picked James O'Connor TD is in the Sunday Independent with an impassioned, not known for his support of his leader, an impassioned plea: only an urgent change of leadership can save our country's soul.
Yeah, I don't think Micheál Martin will be particularly surprised to see this piece from James O'Connor in today's Sunday Independent. And what James is talking about, James is, he's 27 or 28, and he's talking about how many of his friends and people he knows have had to emigrate and have had to leave because they feel there's no hope for them here. There's issues with housing. Government isn't tackling that. They aren't, you know, tackling the infrastructure issue, and you know they're filling gaps basically with what we're talking about, people work coming in on work permits from outside the country. And what James was saying is that he thinks the Taoiseach gets all these issues that are in place, but does he have the urgent commitment to reversing it? And he was saying there's a disconnect between the government and the people, and the government needs to learn from this. And what he was saying is, quote, "I have learned that the darkest hour comes before the dawn, and in that spirit, I believe we need new leadership. The new leadership can emerge from within the current government, but there must be a clear mission to restore opportunity, rebuild trust, and renew our social contract." And as he goes on, like you say, he says the soul of the country depends on it. Now, James has been, I think it's fair to say, a very vocal critic of Micheál Martin. I think this is the clearest terms in which he has called for his leadership to be, for him to be gone from the leadership.
You're the same generation as James O'Connor. Does all those things he's saying there, does it speak to you?
Yeah, James is, I'm a few years older than James, but yeah, I mean, a lot of my friends, I'm at the stage that a lot of my friends are coming home from Australia that would have gone, say, in their mid-20s, and as we get to our late 20s, I'm in my early 30s now, a lot of people are coming home. But in the last couple of years, last couple of months, actually, a lot of my friends have moved to London. We had our...
And why?
Because they feel that they've no prospect of buying here. Some have gone for the experience, they want to live away, but others kind of feel, you know, they're stuck in the rental market and they might as well go and do it in a new place. We had our 10-year school reunion this time last year, actually, and the amount of girls who I went to school with who are now based in London, so again, some for the experience, others because, you know, they feel if they're going to be renting, why rent in Dublin? But they might as well go to London where they feel there's more opportunities.
City, live in London.
Well, yeah, basically, but they feel there's more career prospects. They feel that there's more, you know, there's better public transport, all these kind of things that lead to a better quality of life. So I was, you know, out of my friend group of seven of us, my core friend group, there's only three of us left in Dublin. The others are all living abroad. So I guess it's just the reality of being in your late 20s, early 30s. But yeah, James is right. A lot of people are going because they just don't feel that they've prospects for them here.
Emma, back to the heave that isn't a heave or the slowest heave in history. You were looking at John Lee in the Mail on Sunday. As long as Big Jim stays silent, Micheál will limp on.
Yeah, and I thought it was interesting. He outlined he was talking about when Brian Cowan was ousted as leader, and he was making comparisons, and he was listing, I think he listed four different reasons why this was different, and they included the fact that, you know, really Jim O'Callaghan is the only potential successor, and he's not Micheál Martin. You know, at the time Micheál Martin took over, he was an extremely experienced cabinet member. Jim has been in the position for 10 months, and so there's a big lack of experience there. So, you know, if he stays silent and he's not ready to take that move, we're not going to see an ousting. But I did think his fourth point was to send in the clowns, but don't bother because they're not actually here. And he referred to O'Connor and O'Sullivan, who are the Cork TDs, have been Micheál Martin's harshest critics.
The heavers are all off on junkets.
They're all off on their jollies, yeah. Okay. So they're in Chicago at the rugby and they're on a junket in
Taiwan.
The
most Irish reason for a heave not happening ever.
If they're not here to oust him, he's going to be in place.
So, Gerard, with your...
hilarious, by the way.
One minister during the week, they ran into me. They were like, I haven't seen such and such. You know, the kind of the main orchestrators, I guess, who would be seen as being on the naughty list and against Micheál Martin. Okay. They were like, oh, I haven't seen them around. I was like, oh, they're in Taiwan. You could have knocked him over. He was in such a state of shock. He was like, what do you mean they're in Taiwan? They're meant to be planning a heave and they're not even in the country.
So it could be a post-holiday heave. I know they're not on holidays. I know they're working hard for the nation. Gerard, this heave has become the biggest will they won't they since, I don't know, when Harry met Sally at this stage, because one day it's like yes, they have the numbers, they're going to go, and but really without Jim O'Callaghan it seems to be Hamlet without the prince.
It's a bit of that, and I have a sneaking suspicion that actually not Micheál Martin would actually like to bring this to the boil. That he's apparently trying to calm people, reassure people, tell his side of the story, but there's a bit of him would love to bring this to the boil.
So he could call a motion of confidence in himself.
No, he won't. But he wouldn't mind if people ran ahead prematurely. And I think that should be borne in mind. I mean, my analysis of the Fianna Fáil Parliamentary Party, there's 48 TDs, they're the only people that count. 25 is the magic number. And you could divide it roughly into three thirds. Yeah. There's about one third will get up at any hour of the day or night to do them in. There's about one third that'll probably stick with them in most circumstances.
Because they have jobs.
They have jobs, or there's a few who are with him regardless. And then there's about a third in the middle for whom it is transactional. So Micheál Martin does not have a natural majority, but he does have a working majority for now. I think he realises the danger he's in. He realises that...
So he is still in... Is he still at the acute phase of danger? With each day that passes, does he get out of the emergency room and up to a ward? Or
not quite, because we have this party review coming the week after next. He himself is away at the Environment Conference in Brazil next week. There won't be a meeting of the Parliamentary Party, which tells its own story, by the way. So I think... this is going to go on at this level for at least another week or two or three. Then let's see, does he get into Christmas? If he gets out of Christmas, he's into the new year. He probably has an extended period of time.
What odds would you give him at the moment?
So I think the odds in his favour at this moment are about 60-40.
Okay, so it's close enough. And if he makes it through now, does he make it to July and the beginning of the European presidency and then... He's out the gap at the end of next year, at least. Then,
but the world, if he gets into the presidency and gets out it, and you're out of it, I should say, and he's into early 2027, the world is a different place. Whatever we'll be talking about won't be this, and the dynamics that will influence decisions and those 48 TDs will be different. And all I know is, based on my head count, there's about 6 or 7 people, and if they went one way or the other, it's come or go for Micheál Martin.
Okay, so it's still touch and go. Okay, so there's a poll in the Sunday Independent and Ireland Thinks poll. I'll just give you the breakdown of the parties anyway first, and there's a few other aspects of it that are of interest. And look, this is more than ever, this poll is a snapshot in time. So it was conducted on Friday, 31st of October. Sample size 1609. Margin of error is plus or minus 2.5%. So Sinn Féin are at 23, which is up 2 since 4 weeks ago, the last poll. Fine Gael 19, down 2. Fianna Fáil 18, down 2. Independents and others at 10, down 1. Social Democrats at 9, up 1. Aintu at 6, no change. Independent Ireland at 5, up 1. Labour at 5, up 1. People Before Profit Solidarity at 3, no change. Greens at 2, plus 1. It would strike me about that, Louise. That's all within the margin of error. This is like if you did a full medical on someone who's just been hit by a car. You would have thought that the government parties would be really suffering in this poll. But actually, are they?
I think there will be some kind of angst, I think, particularly in Fianna Fáil, that drop of 2 points. But I think that's just the mood and the way
they are. Catastrophic, like, presidential election. Couldn't have been more catastrophic for them.
No, and I think there's... definitely couldn't have been more catastrophic. But I think there is kind of good parts from this poll that Fianna Fáil will be able to take out of this. So if you look at the front page of the Sunday Independent, 53% say Martin should quit as Fianna Fáil leader.
Are you saying that's a good thing for Fianna Fáil?
I'm saying if you look inside the paper, 45% of people think that Simon Harris should stand down as Fine Gael leader. So is it just like an anti-government thing? And I think what others, and particularly those in the Micheál Martin camp and those kind of middle ground, as they're calling themselves, as a lot of the senior people in Fianna Fáil are calling them, the ones that, you know, they're not particularly, they know there's issues, of course they know there are issues, but they're not necessarily looking for Micheál Martin to go. And what a lot of that middle ground is saying is that a lot of the grassroots are still supporting Micheál Martin. So if you dig deep down into the figures, among Fianna Fáil voters, the picture for Martin's more positive. Just 7% believe he should step down as party leader immediately, compared to 43% of party voters who said he should go in November 2027, which is when the Taoiseach change is happening. So, and I mean, that's realistically what will matter to Micheál Martin and those in Fianna Fáil who support him, is that he still has the support of the Fianna Fáil membership. Well, I'm sure they would like the support of the public. I think the fact that, you know, if you look at the party leader disapproval rate, Holly Curran, she's number one. She's up 4 points to 43%. Actually, it's not party leaders, because Jim O'Callaghan is coming in there behind her on 43%, tied with her actually. Mary Lou MacDonald up 4 points to 38%. Ivana Bacic up 2 to 34. Simon Harris is down 5 to 34. And then Micheál Martin down 10 to 33%. So, of course, they would like him to be popular with the public. But I think he's still popular with the Fianna Fáilers, and that matters to people like Micheál Martin and his
Emma, you think Simon Harris is getting way under the radar here, do you?
A little bit, yeah, because I think one of the big things from that Ireland Thinks poll as well is, like, Micheál Martin was the most popular leader for the past 11 months. So this big drop is as a result of his bad decision to run Jim Gavin as their presidential candidate. So that's one misstep where he's been quite popular. Simon Harris's approval ratings have been slowly declining over since basically he took over, and he's had a couple of poor elections, the Europeans and the local elections, and he was largely absent. And okay, they were, you know, really unfortunate, obviously, with Mairead McGuinness having to step down due to illness, but, you know, Heather Humphreys was an equally disastrous presidential election candidate.
Yeah, no, and largely absent. They have pointed out, I think, eight canvasses that he did with her over the course of, well, you know, he's also the tarnisher of the country. Scott, you raised an interesting word there beforehand, competence. And I think this is in the air, particularly our politicians seem to have become obsessed with that essay by John Collison in the Irish Times. You kind of think, have they ever read a book? Like, do they not know this stuff, or have they been looking around? But anyway, you think competence is an important notion in all of this?
Oh, I think it's fundamental. I think if you look, for example, to a different country, if you look to the Netherlands this week, for all the talk, you know, that you got the far right that are ascendant there, you know, in that case here it's Wilders, or that you've got the left-wing parties that are rising. The Dutch went back to a centrist party. They went to Democracy 66 because they were coming back and saying, what are the issues that matter to you in terms of getting things done? And I get that striking impression with this country as well, which is, I'm pretty sure next time that you let me in the door to talk to y'all, we're going to be talking about housing, we're going to be talking about transport, we're going to be talking about the fundamentals of the economy. Day in, day out. Nothing is shifting. And that leads me to 2 points to add to this great discussion here, first of all. And that is that I think Micheál Martin is okay for now because you don't have the stalking horse with respect to James O'Connor to open the way for Jim O'Callaghan. But I think if you get into next year and we still have what appears to be government paralysis over this, then I think he's actually in trouble if you go a few more months like that. But I think that turns on the second point, which is why voters don't seem to be flocking elsewhere at this point, which is, okay, Sinn Féin, what would you do to show your competence in this situation? If you're talking about the Social Democrats, Labour, what would you do to show your competence? This is different from when you have a challenge to a leadership based on ideology. That's a very different move.
Okay. There's probably a view at the moment, Gerard, that the United Left are looking quite competent because they ran a competent campaign in the face of what looked like two fairly incompetent campaigns from the competent centre. Interestingly, and again, look, we take this with all the qualifiers given, but just to give us an impression of things, in a forced choice, which of the following would be your preferred government? Again, even at this, our darkest hour, did James O'Connor call it? Darkest before the dawn?
Darkest before the
dawn. A left-wing government, potentially including Sinn Féin, Social Democrats, Labour and People Before Profit, would be 43% of people's preferred government. A Fine Gael, Fianna Fáil-led government would be 40%. So they're still there, are thereabouts. But I think you were looking at John Deasy saying the left shouldn't get too excited yet about a new dawn. Is there a new dawn coming from this darkest hour?
I think in relation to the poll, I think the big figure, the only figure that really counts, is housing is still by far the most important issue. Take away all the fluff and the guff, that's what you're left with. In relation to John Deasy's piece in the Business Post, which is excellent, he's saying, you know, hold your horses, exactly as Scott was saying, the numbers don't really add up, can the cohesion stick? And the answer is, we don't know, and only maybe at best. But let me tell you this about the left alliance. It may or may not succeed as a left alliance, I don't know. But what it can do is put pressure on the Fianna Fáil, Fine Gael alliance. And if it pulls it back sufficiently that it can't make it home by itself. But the left alliance doesn't have enough. You know what's going to happen next, because numbers, not principles.
Sinn Féin
and Fianna Fáil. Exactly. So it's not to say it won't be very important. And of course,
Sinn Féin and Fianna Fáil, would they be a million miles apart in terms of the kind of notional left-right kind of ideas?
If in the next all the numbers required, there wouldn't be a cigarette paper between them.
Okay. And by the way, if you look, there was a really good piece in the Mail by Matthew Fenlon, who's doing an analysis of numbers.
Oh, yeah.
If you look at the three elections from...
This is an ex-Fianna Fáil advisor.
He is, to declare a former government advisor, a political DAS and campaign consultant. Between 16 and 24, three elections in which the electorate grew significantly, Fianna Fáil lost 37,000 votes. Mm. In the two local elections... between 19 and 24, it lost 45,000 votes. So it's holding on to a percentage share just about, right, okay? But because...
But the electorate is becoming much more fragmented.
Precisely,
yeah,
precisely.
Yeah. Okay.
And the left alliance may not succeed, but it could be hugely influential.
Okay.
And Sinn Féin, I think, is the one best poised than the other left parties. I mean, I'm glad they're all together now.
Is Sinn Féin going
to bring
all the other boats with them on their rising tide, or will they do what they need to do?
They may actually not be all going on honeymoon together.
Yeah, okay. We'll take a break. Gerard Howland, Scott Lucas, Louise Byrne and Dr. Emma Howard staying with us.
Brendan O'Connor on RTE Radio 1.
Welcome back. Our panel are still here. Gerard Howland, Scott Lucas, Louise Byrne and Dr. Emma Howard. Now, Louise, the breaking news today, I'll tell the story by way of reading the statement from NK Productions and Matt Cooper. This was all happened yesterday as the day went on. Following disclosures in the Irish Independent on Saturday that Ivan Yates provided training services to Fianna Fáil candidate Jim Gavin during the recent presidential election, we have taken the decision to end Ivan's role as co-host of Path to Power, which is a podcast Ivan Yates has with Matt Cooper. With immediate effect, neither Matt Cooper nor NK Productions, this is Noel Kelly's company, were aware that Ivan was working on the campaign. Both believe that this information should have been shared with the audience of the podcast when the presidential election was being discussed. Gerard, just as somebody who is a pundit, but who also you have clients and agendas.
Indeed,
and everything else.
I do.
Without being unduly unfair to anyone, does this look bad for Ivan that he was training Jim Gavin but participated with gusto in the discussion around debates and the presidential election?
Well, I think it requires explanation. And we haven't heard very much from Ivan. He was quoted by Fionnán Sheehan in the Irish Independent. So let's wait and see as to what he says. What I would say in general is that if we're here discussing the price of cabbage and I represent the cabbage growers, first of all, I shouldn't come on if I know that in advance. And if it come up inadvertently, I need to put my hand up and say, well, I represent the cabbage growers. Broadcasters additionally...
No, Ivan did say he wasn't... he said this yesterday, I think, to Fionnán. Mm-hmm. He wasn't involved in policy or strategy or anything. It was merely bread and butter preparing Jim Gavin for debates and interviews, asking him the questions.
Yeah.
And seeing how he
and I get that distinction. But there's also a distinction between people on this side of the table and broadcasters, which is another distinction. And in light of all of that, I think some clarity would be best. And I think in the interests of credibility for people who are listening to any particular conversation on air or on a podcast, it's important to know. I don't think there's any problem. I hope there's no problem. People working for people and getting paid to do it. It's what I do. But I think if there is a conflict or is there an overlap, clarity is fine.
Okay. Louise, Matt Cooper was on with Anton Savage this morning and he's upset.
Yeah, I think that's fair to say. And he was saying that if Ivan had disclosed this work with Jim Gavin during the course of the podcast, or if he had told him or NK management, you know, they could have continued on. It just would have been a qualifying statement. He said that Ivan probably would have ended up being slagged off for Jim Gavin's media performances, but he was big enough and bold enough, I guess, to sum that up but not put words in his mouth. And what he said was that he was hurt, but he is upset about it because this is the end of their working relationship. That they had worked together on The Tonight Show, that he had gone to NK Management, he'd pitched this podcast to them, and himself and Ivan had worked quite well together. The podcast was very successful. I noted this morning...
Ivan was due to finish in the
was due to finish up in early 2026. So the thought, I guess, had already turned to who might replace him. I noted this morning that the subscription edition of the podcast that goes up on a Sunday morning was held back. So I think it'll be interesting to see how Matt does handle this on Friday, but I think he's probably done the right thing.
Okay. Scott, Andrew Mountbatten-Windsor, Loads in the papers today, and obviously the English papers absolutely full of it. You picked a few interesting pieces here. I know this is not one of your hobby horses, but you are you're following this with your usual forensic kind of thing. And I do feel, I was saying this yesterday, this, and I think a lot of people feel, this conversation, it's out of control of the royal family right now. They keep trying to stem it, but it's out of their control. And that it's moving towards suddenly people going, hang on a minute, where are these people? They're living like this. Is a lot of this our money? And as someone said the other night, I saw someone saying, everyone in privileged positions like this now is subject to a lot of scrutiny about their money and their lifestyles and everything. You picked a Sunday Times editorial, Secrecy Over Royal Finances Corrodes Trust in Modern State.
Yeah, because the Sunday Times has an investigation also out today, which says that Andrew pocketed about £15 billion.
Not
15 billion. That would be a scandal. £15 million from the sale of a one of the Crown estates, right? One of the houses.
So just to explain, there are Crown estates, and then there is the duchies of Cornwall and Lancaster, which are owned by the King and Prince William, respectively. And this is regarded as their private kind of birthright to do it as they will.
Yeah,
but massive operations.
Yeah, massive holdings. I mean, the late Queen was one of the richest people on the globe. But
in some way, independently wealthy outside of Crown money.
Yeah, there's a gray area here. I'm an ardent Republican with a small R for reasons like this, which is that there is land which supposedly is held by the Crown, but which is effectively British taxpayer property. Now, one of those estates was sold off to a Kazakh billionaire, and Andrew got the $15 million. For this. That's been one of the reasons why he's been able to continue to fund himself with a pretty lavish lifestyle, despite really not having any other income besides a Royal Navy pension. So that's come out in the Sunday Times alongside the latest over the Epstein allegations regarding him. But to give you a wider context here, again, having served my time in the UK, in the 1990s, when you had the last really major crisis, which was around the death of Princess Diana after the Charles and Di divorce, what really held the monarchy together against a lot of bitterness was the late Queen and also William and Harry when they were behind that funeral cortege when she died. There was that sentiment that was there. So they survived that.
When those two boys, subsequently Harry said like that, that was one of the most traumatic parts of it, being forced out that day to walk behind that. And clearly we now know to kind of save the institution.
Yeah, right. And the institution now is under threat again, in part because of Andrew's behavior and also other challenges, which is the King has had cancer. You bring all of that together, and I think what has happened in the past week is the palace machine, which is very prolific, is spinning that the King and the Queen finally came to the realization that he had to be stripped of the titles, et cetera. I actually think it's more than the King and the Queen. I think it's actually William. William, who is the heir apparent, who may be there sooner rather than later, depends on the King's health. There is already the discord around Prince Harry and his effective detachment from the family. Lines need to be drawn. They need to rebuild the legitimacy, which will be around William. So that's why it's time for Andrew to go. Now, how successful they are in doing that, we'll see in the weeks and months to come.
Gerard, we've really seen in this modern era how quickly institutions that have survived for centuries can suddenly crumble once the scales fall from people's eyes, haven't we?
Well, it's this thing about sunlight being the best disinfectant, but it's sunlight also withers. You know, it few of us could withstand that scrutiny. By the way, in terms of royalty, exceptional privilege, they're also goldfish in a bowl. Edward VII, when he was Prince of Wales at the end of the 19th century, led a riotous private life. Everyone who is anyone knew, but nothing happened. The age of deference is over. And if you go to the late Queen's coronation in the early 1950s, it was the first to be televised. This was the first light, if you like, shining in on monarchy. And 70 years later, that has multiplied and extrapolated into that, you know, these people can do nothing from one hour of the day to the next. They cannot live a private life in any meaningful way. They're held to standards that are the norm in society, which kind of defeats the purpose of being royal. You know, the whole purpose of being royal is that you're an exceptional person. You are above the law. And the king was above the law, traditionally. They were beyond scrutiny. It simply didn't happen. And Andrew is just completely out of sync, out of time, out of place with the society in which he lives. And clearly, there are the most grievous...
There could be contagion here. Louise, you would like, I know, to bring this back to... Virginia Giuffre. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and I think we've spoken a lot about Andrew Mountbatten-Windsor as he is now for the last week, but at the heart of this is the bravery of Virginia Giuffre, who we know took her own life, and her memoir was published this week after her death. But there's a really interesting piece by Sharon Churcher in the Mail on Sunday, and she was the woman who tracked down Virginia Giuffre, and she is the woman who put the pieces together and who initially interviewed her and who got that infamous picture now of Virginia with Andrew and Ghislaine Maxwell in the background. And what Sharon wrote in her piece was that she didn't realise, and neither did Virginia realise, that the impact that this photo was going to have and that it would ultimately change history and the impact it would have on the royal family. But she put a line in her piece and she said, "The story doesn't end with him being Andrew. There are other powerful men who must be held accountable for their role in Jeffrey Epstein and Ghislaine Maxwell's crimes." And I think, you know, Virginia Giuffre and her family said it this week, you know, she's a normal American girl who took down a British prince. She deserves a lot of credit. She had obviously a very, very sad life and she had a very, very sad death. But that can't die with her. The people who were responsible for the pain that she suffered and other young women suffered deserve, you know, they deserve answers and they deserve the perpetrators of those crimes.
Emma, you're nodding.
Here. Yeah, completely agree. Here. And, you know, it's a story of privilege and protected privilege and, you know, one that... It needs to be addressed. You know, one of the issues I think with the royal family is that they're an institution, but they have no rules or guidelines or policies or procedures. You know, so they receive huge amounts of public money, and there are no mechanisms to deal with people who break the rules or who do completely morally reprehensible things. And it's funny, Scott was saying about William apparently being instrumental in Prince Andrew's losing his titles. Apparently the reason they moved out of their home was William had threatened the daughters, Princess Eugenie and Beatrice, that their titles would be removed as well.
Was then denied after.
That was denied, but that's, you know, so you'd wonder where the power lies.
Yeah, with respect to Gerard's point, I just want to say this. I understand the fishbowl and that they're in the fishbowl, but at the heart of this, girls were abused and assaulted and
trafficked.
And that takes that beyond anybody living in a goldfish bowl. That shatters all norms of decent human behavior. And I think that's what his... And the royal family, let's be honest here, they did protect him against those allegations for many years. So this reckoning was due.
Well, the goldfish bowl, by that I mean, is it's inconceivable that a talk of this kind would have percolated into print or online or on air. There was no online or on air. But talk of this kind, which was current in high society around various royal family members over decades in the past, never went further than that in the past because there was an age of deference. That's completely over.
It's gone.
Thank goodness we're past it.
Gerard Howland, Scott Lucas, Louise Byrne and Dr. Emma Howard staying with us. We'll take a break.
Brendan O'Connor on RTE Radio 1.
By the way, just to say that Fianna Fáil have been in touch. The parliamentary party is happening this week, but Louise, I'm correct in saying it'll happen in the absence of the leader.
Yeah, Micheál Martin is away. And if the Fianna Fáil press office are listening, can you respond to my queries too, please?
You can't be using this for personal shout-outs. Okay, so our panel's still here. Gerard Howland, Scott Lucas, Louise Byrne and Dr. Emma Howard. Scott, Tuesday is a big day in your parish. So tell us a bit about Zoran Mamdani and what could happen on Tuesday. Katrina Perry has an excellent piece in Sunday Independent.
Yeah, a great piece. First of all, New York City, a 34-year-old Muslim, raised in Uganda, moved to South Africa, then to the U.S., a state assemblyman, is the favorite to win the election in New York City against a member of the old guard, Andrew Cuomo, the former governor. This is Zoran Mamdani proposing things like rent controls for 4 million New Yorkers because of the cost of living, fare free transport, free childcare, grocery, neighborhood grocery stores supported by the city. He is openly a socialist. That has sparked a firestorm because for many people in America, socialism is still akin to hanging out with Satan. But
they're going for state-sponsored grocery shops.
In certain areas.
Reminiscent of Russia or something, queuing for bread.
I need to emphasize that the better analogy for what's going on with that is probably the co-op stores, the cooperative stores in which the city will provide the premises and pay for the premises. The stores still have to operate with that type of assistance. And it will only be in certain areas of New York which do not have those types of stores.
Now, is it vibes more than anything else there?
No, this is real. This is real. I mean, if you get these types of policies being rolled out in New York, which is a city larger than many countries in the world, this is a counterpoint to the way that the Trump approach, not only to politics, but policy has been held. And then beyond that, because Katrina Perry's piece is very, very good, there are two other important elections at state level are for the governors in New Jersey and Virginia. If the Democrats can take those state houses, one of which is held by a Republican, it means that at the state level, there is momentum. Contrary to what some people have been saying about the Democratic Party being broken, if the Trumpists win those seats, then you've got serious problems for the Democrats going forward.
Okay. Emma, can we take it closer to home and a thing that will be on people's minds today? Either people will have already logged on to revenue.ie and put a price on their home, or people haven't done it yet and are thinking I should be doing it. You picked a few pieces around the local property tax. Maybe Conor Skeehan's piece is kind of interesting, isn't it?
Conor Skeehan's piece, I think, is really interesting because, we don't properly tax property in this country.
So you think it should be more?
I think it should be more. A substantial amount. So 70% of wealth is concentrated in homes in this country. And if we look at our infrastructural needs, the needs to build more housing and our highly concentrated tax base, you know, taxing income, PRSI, VAT are all more distortionary types of taxation than property tax. So yeah, we don't raise enough revenue on it. Since 2021, property prices have gone up about 30%. So for those of us who are lucky enough to own our own homes, that's 30% accumulation of wealth, which we've done nothing to earn.
Yeah, but if you're going to sell your house, like most people, it's their home.
Yeah, and you sell your house and you pay zero capital gains tax if it's your principal private property. So, you know, you've got very small levels. Most people, the average property tax is about €300 a year. And, you know, like I liked Conor Skeehan's piece, you know, he says property tax does not punish success. It recognises that private wealth rests on public foundations. And a robust system can do things like, for example, so we do have some deferrals in place. We can extend those deferrals. So if you think about people, you know, who are on fixed income, who are sitting in homes, but they're retired and those homes are you know, increasing in value a lot, you can defer those property taxes to when their estate is being administered.
So then what would you, the other piece you picked is the Sunday Times.
Yeah.
Sinn Féin saying that Donoghue is taking homeowners for fools over
so property taxes. Sinn Féin are unique in a so-called left party across Europe who want to abolish property taxes. And, you know, as I mentioned, it's essentially a wealth tax in Ireland because that's where most of our wealth are. So yeah, Sinn Féin want to abolish them. O'Donoghue is trying to say like there is a revaluation going on at the moment. I think on average people are going to stay more or less, you know, pay because they've changed the bands, but they've reduced it slightly. We also have county councils are have been reducing, so they have the power to further reduce up to 15%. Many councils do.
Really briefly,
the injustice of a negligible property tax is to force more taxes on people who are houseless,
yep,
who are find it more difficult to save. It is a curse on the generation who don't have houses. It's grossly unfair.
Okay, we leave it at that. Thanks very much to my excellent panel this morning, Gerard Howland, Scott Lucas, Louise Byrne and Dr. Emma Howard. And now it's just 12 noon and we'll go to the newsroom.